Chapter 16. Momum. Those of us who survived will always be bewildered when we recall his arrival, and not just because he was so different then. In a strange sense, he never changed. We changed. If he seems so different to us now, it is because he was the figure that transformed the ground. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Late Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momum. The sun had just set. The man who called himself Anassarimber Kellis sat cross-legged in the light of his fire, outside a pavilion whose canvas slopes had been stitched with black-embroidered eagles, a gift from Proyas, Acamian supposed. In appearance, there was nothing immediately impressive about the man, save perhaps for his long straw-colored hair, which was as fine as ermine and seemed curiously out of place in the firelight. Hair meant for the sun, Acamian thought. The young injured woman who had clutched his side so fiercely the previous day sat next to him, her dress simple yet elegant. The two of them had bathed and exchanged their rags for clothes drawn from the prince's own finery. As he neared, Acamian was struck by the woman's beauty. She had looked little more than a beaten waif earlier. They both watched him approach, their faces vivid in the firelight. "You must be Drusus Acamian," the Prince of Atrathau said.
"Proyas has warned you about me, I see."
The man smiled understandingly. Much more than understandingly. It was unlike any smile Acamian had ever seen. It seemed to understand him much more than he wanted to be understood. Then the realization struck. "I know this man. But how does one recognize a man never met? Unless through a son or other kin, images of his recent dream, of holding the dead face of Anassarimber Kelmomas in his lap, flickered through his soul's eye. The resemblance was unmistakable, the furrow between the brows, the long hollow of the cheeks, the deep-set eyes. He is an Anassarimber. But that's impossible. And yet the times seemed rife with impossible things. Gathered around Momum's grim walls, the Holy War was a sight as astonishing as anything from Acamian's nightmares of the old wars, save perhaps for the heartbreaking battles of Agungaria and the hopeless siege of Golgotharoth. The arrival of the Skilvendi and the Atrathal prince had merely confirmed the absurd scale of the Holy War, as though the ancient histories had themselves come to anoint it.
"One of my seed will return, Seswatha, and Anassarimber will return."
As remarkable as the Skilvendi's arrival had been, it smacked of happenstance. But Prince Anassarimber Kellis of Atrathau was a different story. Anassarimber. Now there was a name. The Anassarimber dynasty had been the third and most magnificent dynasty to rule Cunaiuri. The bloodline the Mandate had thought snuffed out thousands of years before, if not with the death of Kelmomus II on the fields of Eleniot, then certainly with the sack of Great Trice shortly afterward. But not so. The blood of the first great rival of the No-God had somehow been preserved. Impossible.
"At the end of the world."
"Proyas has warned me," Kellis said. "He told me that your kind suffers nightmares of my ancestors." Acamian felt a pang of betrayal at this. He could almost hear the prince. "He'll suspect you of being an agent of the consort, and failing that, he'll hope that Atrathau still wars against the consort, and that you bear news of his elusive enemy. Humor him if you wish, but don't try to convince him that the consort doesn't exist. He will never listen." "But I've always believed," Kellis continued, "that one must ride another man's horse for a day before criticizing."
"To better understand him?"
"No," the man replied with an eye-twinkling shrug. "Because then you're a day away, and you have his horse."
Acamian ruefully shook his head and grinned, and after a moment, all three of them burst out laughing. "I like this man. What if he is who he claims to be?" As their laughter trailed, Kellis introduced him to the woman, Serwe, and bid him welcome. Akamian sat cross-legged on the far side of the fire. Akamian rarely entered situations like this with a definite plan. He usually came with a handful of curiosities and little more. In the process of giving breath to these curiosities, he would ask questions, and in the answers he received, he would find himself looking for certain cues, certain telltale signs of word and expression. He would never know exactly what he was looking for, only that he was looking. When he found whatever it was, he trusted that he would know. A good spy always knew. The inadequacy of this method, however, became apparent from the outset. Never before had he met a man quite like Anasarimba Kellis. There was his voice, which always seemed pitched to the timbre of a promise. At times, Akamian actually found himself straining to listen. Not because the man murmured or because his accent was prohibitive. He displayed a remarkable fluency given his recent arrival, but because his voice had dimension. It seemed to whisper, "There's more that I'm telling you. Only listen and see." And there was his face, the frank drama of its expression. There was an innocence about it, a brevity of display possessed only by the young, though in no way did it strike Akamian as naive. The man appeared wise, amused, and sorrowful by guileless turns, as though he experienced his passions and the passions of others with a startling immediacy. And then there were his eyes, shining soft in the firelight, blue like water that makes one thirst. They were eyes that followed Akamian's every word, as though no amount of attentiveness could do justice to the importance of what he said. And yet, at the same time, they were haunted by a strange reserve, not the reserve of men who make judgments they dare not speak, like Proyas, but the reserve of a man who dwells in the certainty that it's not his place to judge. More than anything, though, it was what the man said that stirred Akamian to awe. "And why have you joined the Holy War?" Akamian asked, trying to convince himself he still thought the man's answer to Proyas fraudulent.
"You're referring to the dreams," Kellis replied.
"I suppose I am." For a brief moment, the Prince of Atrathau regarded him paternally, almost sorrowfully, as though Akamian had yet to understand the rules of this encounter. "Life had been an endless reverie for me before the dreams," he explained. "Itself a dream, perhaps. The dream you ask about, the dream of the Holy War, was a dream that awakens, a dream that makes a dream of one's prior life. What does one do when he has such dreams?" he asked. "Go back to sleep?" Akamian shared his smile.
"Could you?"
"Go back to sleep? No, never, not even if I wanted to. Sleep is never had through wanting. It can't be grasped like an apple to sate one's hunger. Sleep is like ignorance or forgetfulness. The harder one strives for such things, the further they recede from one's grasp."
"Like love," Akamian added.
"Yes, like love," Kellis said softly, glancing at Serwe for a brief instant. "And why have you, a sorcerer, joined the Holy War?" This question caught Akamian off guard. He found himself answering more openly than he'd intended.
"I don't know why. Because I've been directed by my school, I suppose."
Kellis smiled gently, as though recognizing a shared pain.
"But what's your purpose here?"
Akamian bit his lip, but did not flinch from the humiliating truth otherwise.
"We search for an ancient and implacable evil," he said slowly, with the resentment of men who are often ridiculed. "An evil that we haven't been able to find for more than 300 years. And yet, night after night, we're afflicted by dreams of the horrors that evil once wrought." Kellis nodded, as though even this mad admission found some precedent in his own life.
"It's difficult, is it not, to search for those things we cannot see?"
These words filled Akamian with an unaccountable sorrow.
"Yes, very difficult."
"Perhaps, Akamian, we're not so different, you and I."
"How do you mean?"
But Kellis did not answer. He did not need to.
The man had sensed his earlier incredulity, Akamian realized, and had answered it by showing him the irony of one man anguished by dreams denying another man the rapture of his. Suddenly, Akamian found himself believing the man's story. How could he believe in himself otherwise? Despite these moments of subtle instruction, Akamian realized the man's discourse and manner knew absolutely nothing of edict. Their conversation was devoid of the intangible rivalries that hung like an odor, sometimes sweet but mostly sour, about the exchanges of other men. Because of this, their talk possessed the character of a voyage. At times they laughed, and other times they fell silent, stilled by the gravity of their themes. And these moments were like way stations, small shrines by which to orient a greater pilgrimage. This man, Akamian realized, was not interested in convincing him of anything. Certainly there were things he wished to show him, things he hoped to share, but each was offered within the frame of a common understanding. Let us be moved, you and I, by the things themselves. Let us discover each other. Before coming to their fire, Akamian had been prepared to be very suspicious, even bitterly critical, of anything the man might say. The ancient north was now home to countless tribes of Srunk. Its great cities, Trisi, Soglish, Mikle, Kelmiol, and the others, all gutted ruin, 2,000 years dead. And where Srunk ranged, no man could go. The ancient north was dark to the mandate, inscrutable. And Atrathau was a lone beacon in that darkness, frail before the long hoary shadow of Golgotharoth. A single light held against the black heart of the consult. Centuries passed, when the consult still skirmished openly with the mandate, at Ursus had maintained a mission in Atrathau. But the mission had gone silent centuries ago, shortly before the consult itself withdrew into obscurity. Periodically, they'd sent expeditions north to investigate, but they invariably failed, either turned back by the Galioth, who were exceedingly jealous of the northern caravan route, or vanishing into the vast Istuli plains, never to be seen again. As a result, the Mandate knew very little of Atrathau, only what could be gleaned from the traders who managed to survive the great circuit from Atrathau to Galioth. And hence, Akamian knew he would be utterly captive to the facts as Kellis portrayed them. He would have no way of knowing whether he spoke truthfully, no way of knowing whether he was a prince of anything at all. And yet, Anasarimber Kellis was a man who moved the souls of those around him. Speaking with him, Akamian found himself arriving at insights he would scarcely have had otherwise, finding answers to curiosities he'd never before dared admit, as though his very soul had been at once quickened and opened. According to the commentaries, the philosopher Agensis had been such a man. And how could a man like Agensis lie? It was as though Kellis were himself a living revelation, an exemplar of truth. Akamian found himself trusting him, trusting despite 1,000 years of suspicion. The night waxed, and the fire burned perilously low. Serwe, who had said very little, lay asleep with her head upon Kellis's lap. Her sleeping face stirred a wan loneliness within Akamian.
Do you love her?
Akamian asked. Kellis smiled ruefully. Yes, I need her.
She worships you, you know. I can tell by the way she watches you.
But this seemed to sadden Kellis. His face darkened.
I know, he said at length. For some reason she makes more of me than I am. Others do this as well.
Perhaps, Akamian said with a smile that felt curiously false, they know something you don't.
Kellis shrugged. Perhaps. He looked at Akamian earnestly. Then, with a pained voice, he added, Ironic, isn't it?
And what's that?
Here you possess privileged knowledge, and yet no one believes you, while I possess nothing, and everyone insists that I have privileged knowledge. And Akamian could only think, But do you believe me?
How do you mean?
He asked. Kellis looked at him pensively. This afternoon a man fell to his knees before me and kissed the hem of my robe.
He laughed then, as though still astonished by the sad absurdity of the act.
Your dream, Akamian said matter-of-factly. He thinks that the gods move you.
I assure you, they haven't moved me otherwise. Akamian doubted this and for a moment found himself frightened. Who is this man?
They sat silently for a while. Distant shouts sounded from somewhere in the surrounding encampment.
Drunks.
Dog!
Someone bellowed.
Dog!
I do believe you, you know, Kella said at last. Akamian's heart fluttered, but he said nothing. I believe in your school's mission. It was Akamian's turn to shrug.
That makes two of you.
Kellas chuckled. And who, may I ask, is my gullible companion?
A woman, Esmanette, a prostitute whom I've known from time to time.
Akamian could not help glancing at Serwe as he said this. Not as beautiful as this woman, but beautiful nonetheless.
Kellas had been watching him closely. She's a beautiful woman, I imagine.
She's a prostitute, Akamian replied, yet again unnerved by his ability to speak his thoughts.
Akamian blamed the silence that followed on these sour words. He repented them, but could not take them back.
He looked to Kellas, his eyes apologetic. But the matter had already been forgiven and forgotten. The silences between men are always fraught with uncomfortable significance. Accusations, hesitations, judgments of who is weak and who is strong. But silences with this man undid rather than sealed these things. The silence of Anasarimber Kellas said, Let us move on, you and I, and recall these things at a better time.
There's something, Kellas said at length, I would ask of you, Akamian, but I fear that our acquaintance is too slight.
Such honesty, if only I could follow.
All one can do, Kellas, is ask.
The man smiled and nodded.
You're a teacher, and I'm an ignorant stranger in a bewildering land. Would you consent to teach me?
With these words, 100 questions assailed Akamian, but he found himself saying,
I would consider myself fortunate, Kellas, to count an Anasarimber among my students.
Kellas grinned.
It's agreed, then. I count you, Drusus Akamian, my first friend amid this wonder.
These words aroused an odd shyness in Akamian, and he found himself relieved when Kellas stirred Serwe and told her they were about to retire. Afterward, negotiating the dark canvas alleys leading to his own tent, Akamian experienced a strange euphoria. Though the increments of such things have no measure, he felt subtly transformed by his encounter with Kellas, as though he'd been shown a much-needed example of something profoundly human. An example of life's own proper pose. Lying awake in his humble tent, he dreaded sleep. The prospect of suffering the nightmares yet again seemed unbearable. Insight, he knew, was as often snuffed as kindled by trauma. When slumber at last overcame him, he dreamed anew of the disaster on the fields of Eleniot, of the death of Anasarimber Kelmomus II beneath Srank hammers. And when he awoke, gasping for sober air, the voice of the dying High King, so similar to Kellas's own, resounded through his soul, overwhelmed his heart's rhythm with its prophetic cadences.
One of my seed will return, Seswatha, and Anasarimbor will return at the end of the world.
But what did this mean? Was Anasarimber Kellas in fact a sign, as Proyas hoped? A sign not of the gods' divine sanction of the holy war, as Proyas assumed, but of the no-gods' imminent return.
The end of the world.
Akamian began trembling, shaking with a horror he'd never before experienced while awake.
The no-god returning? Please, sweet Sejanus, let me die before—
It was unthinkable. He hugged his shoulders and rocked in the blackness of his tent, whispering,
No,
over and over again,
No, please, this can't be happening. Not to me. I'm too weak. I'm just a fool.
Beyond the canvas of his tent, all seemed airy silence. Innumerable men slumbered, dreaming of terror and glory against the heathen,
and they knew nothing of what Akamian feared. They were innocents, like Proyas, filled by the heedless momentum of their faith, thinking that a place, a city called Shima, was the very nail about which the fate of the world spun. But the nail, Akamian knew, was to be found in a far darker place, a place far to the north where the earth wept pitch, a place called Golgotharoth. For the first time in many, many years, Akamian prayed. Reason returned afterward, and he felt slightly foolish. As extraordinary as Kellis had been, there was really nothing other than the dreams of Kelmomus and the coincidence of a name to warrant such a terrifying conclusion. Akamian was a skeptic, and he prided himself on the fact. He was a student of the ancients, of Agensis, and a practitioner of logic. The second apocalypse was but the most dramatic of 100 banal conclusions, and if anything defined his waking life, it was banality. Nevertheless, he lit his candle with a sorcerous word and rummaged through his pouch, retrieving the map he had made shortly before joining the Holy War. He glanced at the names scattered across the parchment, pausing at Mathenet. So long as the old antagonism between him and Proyas persisted, he realized he would have little hope of learning more about Mathenet or of forwarding his investigation of Inrau's death. "I'm sorry, Inrau," he thought, forcing his eyes away from his beloved student. Then he studied the consult, scratched, far more hastily it now seemed to him, all alone in the top right corner, and still isolated from the thin web of connections that joined the others. In the candlelight, it seemed to waver against the pale, mottled sheet, as though it were something too deranged to be captured in ink. He dipped his quill in the horn, then carefully scrawled, Anasarimber Kellis, below the hated name. With a reluctant gait of a man unsure of his destination, Nayor walked through the encampment. The lane he followed wound between a jumble of slumbering camps. Here and there a fire still burned, tended by muttering men, mostly drunk. Odors assailed him, bearing the sharpness of foul smells in cool, dry air. Livestock, rancid meat, and oily smoke. Some fool was burning wet wood. Memories of his recent meeting with Proyas dominated his thoughts. To cement his plan to outmaneuver the Emperor, the Kunrayan prince had sought counsel from the 5 Kunrayan Palatines who had taken up the tusk, proud men wagging proud tongues. Even the more bellicose Palatines, such as Gaedeki or Ingaiaban, spoke more to score than to solve. Watching them, Nayur had realized they all played an infantile version of the same game the Dunyain played. Words, Moengus and Kellis had taught him, could be used hand open or fist closed as a way to embrace or a way to enslave. For some reason, these Enrithi, who had nothing tangible to gain or to lose from one another, all spoke with their fists closed. Fatuous claims, false concessions, mocking praise, flattering insults, and an endless train of satiric innuendos. Janan, they called it. A mark of caste and cultivation. Nayur had weathered the farce as best he could, but inevitably, it now seemed, they soon cast their nets about him as well.
"Tell me, Skjelvendi," Lord Gaedeki had asked, flushed with drink and daring. "Those scars of yours, do they reflect the man or the man's measure?"
"How do you mean?"
The Palatine of Anpli grinned.
"Well, I should think that if you, say, killed Lord Gunyama here, he would deserve 2 scars at the most. But if you were to kill me..."
He looked to the others, his eyebrows raised and his lips drawn down, as though speaking in deference to their learned opinions.
"What? 20 scars? 30?
"I suspect," Proyas said, "that Skjelvendi swords are great levelers." Lord Imrotha laughed too hard at this.
"Swazond," Nayur said to Gaedeki, "measure foes, not fools."
He stared impassively at the startled Palatine, then spat into the fire. But Gaedeki was not easily intimidated.
"So, what am I?"
he asked dangerously. "Fool or foe?"
In that moment, Nayur recognized yet another hardship he would have to suffer in the months to come. The perils and deprivations of war were nothing. He had shouldered them his entire life. The disgrace of consorting with Kellis was a hardship of a different order, but something he could endure in the name of hate. But the degradation of participating day after day in the peevish, unmanly ways of the Enrithi was something he had not considered. How much must he suffer to see vengeance done? Thankfully, Proyas deftly preempted his reply to Gaedeki, declaring the council at an end. Too disgusted to bear their farewell fencing, Nayur had simply marched from the pavilion into the night. He let his gaze wander as he walked. The moon was full and bright, smudging silver across the back of charging clouds. Moved by a peculiar melancholy, he looked to the stars. Skilvendi children were told that the sky was a yaksh, impossibly vast and pricked by innumerable holes. He remembered his father pointing skyward once.
"See, Nayu," he had said. "See the thousand lights peeking through the leather of night? This is how we know that a greater sun burns beyond this world. This is how we know that when it's night, it is truly day, and that when it's day, it is truly night. This is how we know, Nayu, that the world is a lie."
For Skilvendi, the stars were a reminder. Only the people were true. Nayur paused. The dust beneath his sandals still shed the sun's heat. Throughout the immediate darkness, the silence seemed to hiss. What was he doing here, among Enrithi dogs? Among men who scratched breath upon parchment and sustenance from dirt, among men who had sold their souls into bondage, among the cattle. What was he doing? He raised his hands to his brows, drew his thumbs across his eyes, squeezed. Then he heard the Dunyane's voice drifting through the dark. With his eyes pinched shut, he felt a youth once again, standing in the heart of the Utumut encampment, overhearing Moengus talk to his mother. He saw Banut's bloodied face, grinning rather than grimacing as he strangled him.
"Weeper."
Running fingernails across his scalp, he continued walking. Through a screen of dark camps, he glimpsed the Dunyane's firelight. He saw the bearded schoolman, Drusus Akamian, sitting, leaning forward as though straining to listen. Then he saw Kellis and Serwe, fire bright against the surrounding murk. Serwe slept, her head upon the Dunyane's lap. He found a place beside a wain where he could watch. He crouched. Nayur had intended to scrutinize what the Dunyane said, hoping to confirm any one of his innumerable suspicions. But he quickly realized that Kellis was playing this sorcerer the way he played all the others, battering him with closed fists, beating his soul down paths of his manufacture. Certainly, it did not sound like this. Compared with the banter of Proyas and his palatines, what Kellis said to the schoolman possessed a heartbreaking gravity, but it was all a game, one where truths had become chits, where every open hand concealed a fist. How could one determine the true intent of such a man? The thought struck Nayur that Dunyane monks might be even more inhuman than he had thought. What if things such as truth and meaning had no meaning for them? What if all they did was move and move like something reptilian, snaking through circumstance after circumstance, consuming soul after soul for the sake of consumption alone? The thought made his scalp prickle. They called themselves students of the Logos, the shortest way. But the shortest way to what? Nayur cared nothing for the schoolman, but the sight of Serwe, asleep with her head upon Kellis's thighs, filled him with uncharacteristic fear, as though she lay within the coils of some malevolent serpent. Scenarios flashed through his soul, of stealing away with her in the dead of night, of grabbing her, peering so hard into her eyes that her center would be touched, then telling her the truth of Kellis. But these glimpses gave way to fury. What kind of fawn-hearted thoughts were these,
always straying, always wandering across the trackless and the weak, always betraying. Serwe frowned and fidgeted, as though troubled by a dream. Kellis absently stroked her cheek. Unable to look away, Nayur beat his fists against the dust.
She is nothing.
The schoolman departed a short time after. Nayur watched Kellis steer Serwe to their pavilion. She was so like a little girl when roused from sleep. Body swaying, head bowed, watching her feet through pouting lashes. So innocent. And pregnant, Nayur now suspected. Several moments passed before the Dunyane reappeared. He walked to the fire, began dousing it by prodding the pit with a stick. The last licks of flame winked out, and Kellis became an eerie apparition, etched by the orange pool of coals at his feet. Without warning, he looked up. How long were you intending to wait? He asked in Skilvendi. Nayur pulled himself to his feet, beat the dust from his breeches.
Until the sorcerer was gone.
Kellis nodded. Yes. The people despise witches. Despite the Dunyane's proximity, Nayur stood near enough the coals to feel their arid heat. Ever since Kellis had swung him over the precipice that day in the mountains, he'd found himself battling a strange bodily shyness whenever the man loomed next to him.
No man cows me. What do you want from the men?
He asked, spitting into the coals. You heard. Instruction.
I heard. What do you want from him?
Kellis shrugged. Have you even asked yourself why my father has summoned me to Shima?
You said you didn't know. So you said.
But to Shima. Kellis looked at him sharply. Why Shima?
Because that's where he dwells.
The Dunyane nodded. Indeed. Nayur could only stare. There was something Proyas had said to him earlier this night. He had asked the man about the Scarlet Spires, about the school's reasons for joining the Holy War, and Proyas had replied as though startled by his ignorance. Shima, he had said, was the home of the Kishorim. The words were pasty in his mouth.
You think Moengas is Kishorim?
He summoned me by sending dreams. Of course, Moengas had summoned him using sorcery. Sorcery. He'd said as much himself when Kellis first mentioned the dreams. But then, why had the connection escaped him? Only the Kisharim practiced sorcery among the Fainim. Moengas simply had to be Kisharim. He knew this, but... Nayur scowled.
You said nothing to me. Why?
You didn't want to know. Was that it? Had he hidden from this knowledge? All this time, Moengas had been little more than a shadowy destination, at once elusive and compelling, like the object of some obscene carnal urge. And yet he had never truly asked Kellis about him. Why?
I need know only the place.
But such thoughts were foolishness, juvenile. Great hunger yielded no feasts. So the memorialists admonished headstrong Skilvendi youths. So Nayur himself had admonished Zunarit and the other chieftains before Kaiuth. And yet here, on the deadliest pilgrimage of his entire life. The Dunyane watched him, his expression expectant, even sorrowful. But Nayur knew better. Knew something not quite human studied him from behind his all-too-human face. Scrutiny so utter, so exacting. It was palpable.
You can see me, can't you? See me looking back at you.
Then he understood. He hadn't asked Kellis about Moengas, because asking betokened ignorance and need. He might as well bare his throat to a wolf as display such deficits to a Dunyane. He hadn't asked about Moengas, he knew, because Moengas was here, in his son. He could not say this, of course. Nayur spat.
I know little of the schools, he said, but I do know this. Mandate schoolmen do not reveal the secrets of their practice to anyone. If you wish to learn sorcery, you're wasting your time with that sorcerer.
He'd spoken as though Moengas had not been mentioned. The Dunyane, however, did not bother feigning puzzlement.
They both stood, he realized, in the same dark place, the same shadowy nowhere beyond the Benjuka plate.
I know, Kellis replied.
He told me of the Gnosis. Nayur kicked dust across the coals, studied the scatter of black over the pitted glow. He began walking to the pavilion.
30 years, Kellis called from behind. Moengus has dwelt among these men for 30 years. He'll have great power, more than either of us could hope to overcome.
I need more than sorcery, Nayur. I need a nation, a nation.
Nayur paused, looked skyward once again.
So it's to be this holy war, then, is it?
With your help, Skilvendi. With your help.
Day for night, night for day. Lies. All lies. Nayor continued walking, striding between barely visible guy ropes to the canvas flaps. To Serwe.
For several moments, the Emperor stared at his old council in stunned silence. Despite the late hour, the man still wore the charcoal silk robes of his station. He'd breathlessly entered Zarius's private apartment only moments earlier as his body slaves were preparing him for bed.
Could you kindly repeat what you just said, dear Scales? I fear I misheard you.
His eyes downcast, the old man said,
Proyas has apparently found a Skilvendi, who's warred against the heathen before, inflicted a crushing defeat upon them, actually, and has now proposed to Maethanet that he'll be a suitable replacement for Confis.
Outrage! Impertinent, overweening Conryan dog!
Zarius swung his palms through the scrambling crowd of prepubescent slaves. A young boy skidded prostrate across the marble floor, wailing and shielding his face. There was the clash of spilled decanters. Zarius stepped over him, confronting old Scaeus.
Proyas! Was there ever a more grasping man alive, thieving, black-hearted wretch?
Scaeus stuttered a hasty reply.
Never, god of men, but this is unlikely to interfere with our divine purpose.
The old council was careful to keep his gaze firmly fixed on the floor. No one may look the emperor in the eye. This, Zarius thought, was why he truly seemed a god to these fools. What was god but a tyrannical shadow in one's periphery, the voice that could never fall within one's field of vision, the voice from nowhere?
Our purpose, Scales?
Dreadful silence, broken only by the child's whimper.
Yes, a god of men. The man is a Skilvendi. A Skilvendi leading the holy war? Surely this is little more than a joke.
Zarius breathed deeply. The man was right, wasn't he? This was but one more way for the Conryan prince to gall him, like the raids down the river Phaeth. And yet he still found himself troubled. Something odd about his prime council's manner. Zarius valued Scaeus far above any other of his preening lapdog advisers. In Scaeus, he found the perfect marriage of subservience and intellect, of deference and insight. But lately he had sensed a pride, an illicit identification of counsel and edict. Studying the frail form, Zarius felt himself calm, the calm of suspicion.
Have you heard the saying, Scaeus? Cats look down upon man and dogs look up, but only pigs dare look man straight in the eye.
Yes, god of men.
Pretend that you are a pig, Scaeus.
What would be in a man's face when he looked into the countenance of God? Defiance? Terror? What should be in a man's face?
The aged, clean-shaven face slowly turned and lifted, glimpsed the Emperor's eyes before turning back to the floor.
You tremble, Scaeus, Zarius muttered. That is good.
A Commian sat patiently before a small breakfast fire, sipping the last of his tea, listening absently as Zynemus briefed Orissus and Dinchazes on the morning agenda. The words meant little to him. Since meeting an Asarimber Kellis, a Commian had fallen into a funk of obsessive brooding. No matter how hard he tried, he could not fit the Prince of Atrathau into anything that resembled sense.
No less than 7 times had he prepared the Cants of Calling to inform at Ursus of his discovery. No less than 7 times had he faltered mid-verse, trailing into murmurs. Of course, the mandate had to be told. News that an Anasarimber had arrived would send Nortzira, Simus, and the others into an uproar. Nortzira in particular, Akamia knew, would be convinced that Kellis marked the fulfillment of the Kelmomian prophecy, that the second apocalypse was about to begin. Though every man occupied the center of whatever place he found himself, men such as Nortzira believed they occupied the center of their time as well. I live now, they would think without thinking, therefore something momentous must happen. But Akamian was not such a man. He was rational, and as such, compelled to be skeptical. The libraries of At-Ursus were littered with proclamations of impending doom, every generation just as convinced as the last that the end was nigh. Akamian could think of no delusion more dogged and few conceits more worthy of scorn. The arrival of Anasarimber Kellis simply had to be a coincidence. In the absence of any supporting evidence, he decided, reason compelled him to adopt this conclusion. The missing thumb of the matter, as the Einani say, was that he could not trust the mandate to likewise withhold judgment. After centuries of starving for crumbs, they would, Akamian knew, fall into a frenzy over a scrap such as this. So the question cycled through his soul, and more he began to fear the answers. How would Nortzira and others interpret his tidings? What would they do? How ruthless would they be in the prosecution of their fears? I gave them Inrau. Must I give them Kellis too? No. He had told them what would happen to Inrau. He had told them, and they had refused to listen. Even his old teacher, Simus, had betrayed him. Akamian was a mandate schoolman as they were. He dreamed the dream of Seswatha as they did. But unlike Nortzira and Simus, he had not been gouged of his compassion. He knew better. And more important, he knew Anasarimber Kellis. Or at least something of him. Enough, perhaps. Akamian set down his bowl of tea, then leaned forward, elbows on knees. What do you make of the newcomers, then?
The Skilvendi? Quick-witted, bloodthirsty, and catastrophically loutish. No slight goes unpunished with that one, if only because he bristles at everything.
He cocked his head, adding, Don't tell him I said that. Akamian grinned. I mean the other one, the Prince of Atrithau. The marshal became uncharacteristically solemn.
Truthfully?
He asked after a moment's hesitation. Akamian frowned.
Of course.
I think there's something...
He shrugged.
Something about him?
How so?
Well, there's the name, which made me suspicious at first. Actually, I've been meaning to ask you.
Akamian raised a hand. After. Zynemus breathed deeply, shook his head. Something about his manner made Akamian's skin tingle.
I don't know what to think, he said finally.
Either that, or you're afraid to say what you think. Zynemus glared at him.
You spent an entire evening with him. You tell me. Have you ever met a man like him?
No, Akamian admitted.
So what makes him different?
He's better. Better than most men.
Most men? Or do you mean all men?
Akamian regarded Zynemus narrowly. He frightens you.
Sure, so does the Skelvendi, for that matter.
But in a different way. Tell me, Zin, just what do you think Anasarimber Kellis is? Prophet or prophecy?
More,
Zynemus said decisively.
More than a man.
A long silence ensued, filled only by the shouts of some distant commotion.
The fact is, Akamian finally ventured, neither of us knows anything.
What's this now?
Zynemus exclaimed, staring over Akamian's shoulder. The schoolman craned his neck.
What's what?
At first glance, it appeared that a mob approached.
Crowds jostled through the narrow lane while clots of men filtered through the surrounding camps. Men trudged through fire pits, pulled down laundry lines, knocked ad hoc chairs and grills aside. A Commian even saw a pavilion half collapse as the men streaming around it barged through its guy ropes. But then he glimpsed a disciplined formation of crimson-clad soldiers filing through the heart of the multitude, and in their midst, a rectangle of bare-backed slaves carrying a mahogany palanquin.
"A procession of some kind," Zynima said. "But who would—"
His voice trailed. They had both glimpsed it at the same time. A long crimson banner capped by the Ainoni pictogram for truth and bearing a coiled three-headed serpent, the symbol of the Scarlet Spires. The gold stitching shimmered in the sun.
"Why would they fly their standard like that?" Zynimus asked.
Good question. For many men of the Tusk, all that separated sorcerers from heathens was that sorcerers were even more fit to burn. Striking their mark in the heart of the encampment was nothing short of foolhardy. Unless...
"Do you have your koray?" a Commian asked.
"You know I don't wear it when—"
"Do you have it?"
"With my things. Fetch it. Quickly."
They flew their standard, a Commian realized, for his benefit. They had a choice. Either risk inciting a mob, or risk startling a mandate schoolman. The fact that they thought the latter a greater threat testified to the wretched relations between their two schools. Obviously, the Scarlet Spires wanted to make his acquaintance. But why? Sure enough, the riotous throngs grew closer as the procession stubbornly battled its way forward. A Commian saw clods of dirt explode into dust against the palanquin. Cries of "Gerwicka," a common pejorative for sorcerer among the Norserai, soon rifled the sky. Zynimus hastened from his pavilion, bawling orders to his slaves as he did so. His brigandine swung from his shoulders unfastened, and he clutched his scabbard in his left hand. Many of his men were already gathering about him. A Commian saw dozens of others scrambling from all corners of their immediate vicinity, but their numbers seemed no match for the brawling hundreds, perhaps even thousands, who approached. With characteristic brusqueness, Zynimus swatted a path through his men to a Commian's side.
"Are you sure they're coming for you?"
he shouted over the growing roar.
"Why else would they strike their mark? By making this public, they guarantee witnesses. As strange as it sounds, I think they do this to reassure me."
Zynimus nodded thoughtfully.
"They forget how much they're hated."
"Who doesn't?" The marshal glanced at him strangely, then looked to the nearing mob, scratching his beard.
"I'm going to set up a perimeter, or try to anyway. You stay here. Stay visible. When whoever the fool is meets with you, you tell him to lower his mark and skulk away immediately. Immediately! Do you understand?"
The words stung. In all the years a Commian had known Cryjati Zynimus, the man had never barked commands at him. The ever-amiable Zynimus had abruptly become the marshal of a Trempas, a man with a task and numerous men at his disposal. But this, a Commian realized, wasn't what hurt. The situation, after all, called for decisiveness. What stung was the undertone of anger, the sense that his friend somehow blamed him. A Commian watched as Zynimus harassed his men into a line, then, with the help of Dinchezes, positioned them in a thin semicircle through the surrounding camps, using the stagnant canal that curled behind them to protect their flanks. There was a bustling moment as the slaves hastened to put out the fire they had been poking just moments earlier. Others rushed off into the slots between tents to smother whatever open flame they could find. The mob and the Scarlet Spires was nearly upon them. Zynimus's soldiers had linked arms, and the first of the rioters began gathering before them, flushed and in no mood for constraint. At first, they simply milled in confusion, hollering insults in a variety of different tongues. But as the procession neared, their numbers grew. They became bolder. A Commian saw a wild-haired Thunieri throwing punches, only to be dragged down by his own comrades.
Other bands linked arms as well and tried to force their way through the line. Zynemus threw what few spare men he had into these shoving matches, and for the time being at least, managed to forestall any breaks. The standard of the Scarlet Spires trundled nearer, pausing, then advancing, then pausing again. Overheads, Akamian glimpsed polished black staffs rising and falling as though a great centipede had been upended. Then he glimpsed the Javra, the slave soldiers of the Scarlet Spires, beating their way forward with grim determination. The enigmatic palanquin moved forward with them. Who could it be? Who would be fool enough? Suddenly, a wedge of Javra broke clear and came face to face with Zynemus's men. There was a moment of confusion. Zynemus rushed to clarify matters, coming within reaching distance as he did so. Beyond, the palanquin swayed as its bearers struggled against the heave of massed bodies. The three-headed serpent tipped in the breeze, but otherwise stood still. Then exhausted Javra were spilling through the line, bruised, bloody. Some even needed to be carried bodily. The palanquin followed, like a boat popping through a broken dike. Zynemus watched as though thunderstruck. Then everything, it seemed, came raining down upon them. Looted plates, wine bowls, chicken bones, stones, and even the corpse of a cat, which a commune was forced to duck. Apparently unaffected, the slaves gently lowered their burden by kneeling until their foreheads touched dust, and the palanquin rested across their tanned backs. The downpour ceased, and the shouts grew more and more sporadic. Akamian found himself holding his breath. A Javra captain drew aside a wicker screen, then immediately fell to his knees. A crimson-slippered foot appeared, followed by the embroidered folds of a magnificent gown. There was an instant of utter silence. It was Eleazarus himself, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires and de facto ruler of High Anon. Akamian found himself struck dumb by disbelief. The Grand Master? Here? Some few among the mob, it seemed, knew what he looked like. A great murmur passed through them, swelling for several moments, then fading as the import of what they witnessed struck them. They stood in the presence of one of the most powerful men in the Three Seas. Only the Shraya or the Padiraja could claim more power than the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires. Blasphemer or not, a man of such power commanded respect, and respect commanded silence. Eleazarus raked his onlookers with amused eyes, then turned to Akamian. He was tall, statuesque in the manner of thin, gressel men. He walked as though along a balance, one foot before another. He kept his hands folded in his sleeves, as was the formal custom of Eastern Magi. Halting at the distance prescribed by Janan, he graced Akamian with a shallow bow. Akamian glimpsed tan scalp beneath thinning gray hair, which was braided into an elaborate bun at the back of his neck.
"You must excuse the company I happen to be keeping," he said, waving a dismissive long-fingered hand at the gawking throngs. "Spectacle is ever the narcotic, I'm afraid."
"As are contradictions," Akamian replied blandly. As astonishing as this impromptu audience might be, the Scarlet Spires was no friend of Mandate Schoolman. He saw no reason to pretend otherwise.
"Indeed. I was told you were a student of Agensis's logic. You make quite irresistible morsels, you Mandate Schoolman. Did you know?"
"A nanai," Akamian thought sourly.
"We're always fighting off the scavengers, if that's what you mean."
Eleazarus shook his head.
"Don't flatter yourself. Conceit does not sit well with martyrdom. Never has, never will."
"I always thought them the same."
The surrounding mob had grown more unruly, forcing him to raise his voice. The Grand Master's lips tightened into a sour line.
"Clever man, clever little man. Tell me, Drusus Akamian, how is it that after all these years you still find yourself in the field, Did you offend someone? Not Sarah, perhaps?
Or did you bugger Proyas as a boy? Is that why House Nerse sent you packing those years ago?
Akamian was speechless. They had researched him, armed themselves with as many painful facts and innuendos as they could find, and here he thought he was watching them.
Ah, Eleazar said. You didn't expect me to be quite so tactless, did you? The blunt knife, I assure you, has its...
Unclean wretches!
Someone howled with alarming ferocity. More shouts followed. Akamian glanced around, saw that Zynemus's men were once again scuffling to hold their position. Many in Rethi leaned over their linked arms, screaming obscenities.
Perhaps we should retire to the Marshal's pavilion, Eleazar said.
Akamian glimpsed Zynemus's furious face behind the Grand Master. That's not possible.
I see.
What do you want, Eleazarus? Zynemus had bid Akamian to end this meeting before it started, but this he could not do. Not only did he speak to Eleazarus, the mightiest anagogic sorcerer in the Three Seas, he also spoke to the man who had negotiated his school's treaty with Mathanet. Perhaps Eleazarus knew how Mathanet had learned of their war with the Kishorim. Perhaps he would trade that knowledge for whatever it was he wanted.
Want? The Grand Master repeated. Why, merely to make your acquaintance. The few, if you haven't already noticed, are somewhat...
His eyes darted to and from the rumbling mass of Enrithi.
Out of place here. Janan demands our affiliation. As well as tedious obscurity, it seems.
The Grand Master smiled.
But not mockery. Never mockery. That is a mistake only half-tutored prigs make. The true practitioner of Janan never laughs at another more than he laughs at himself.
Fucking Anani. What do you want, Eleazarus?
To make your acquaintance, as I said. I needed to meet the man who has utterly overturned my impression of the Mandate. To think that I once thought yours the gentlest of schools.
Now Akamian was genuinely perplexed. What are you talking about?
I'm told you were recently a resident of Karathuzel.
Geshruni. They had discovered Geshruni. Did I kill you too? Akamian shrugged. So, your secret is out. You war against the Kishorim. How could they begrudge him this when they had made it plain to all by joining the Holy War? There had to be more. The Gnosis? Did Eleazarus merely distract him while others probed his wards? Was this simply a bold prelude to abduction? It had happened before.
Our secret is out, Eleazarus agreed. But then, so is yours.
Akamian fixed him with quizzical look. The man spoke as though to goad him with knowledge of some obscene secret, one so shameful that any allusion, no matter how indirect, simply could not be understood. And yet he had no idea what the man was talking about.
It was sheer coincidence, Eleazarus continued, that we found his body. It was brought to us by a fisherman who works the mouth of the river Seyut. But it wasn't so much the fact that you killed him that troubled us. After all, in the greater game of Benjuka, one often gains pieces by disposing of them. No, what troubled us was the manner.
Me? He laughed incredulously. You think I killed Geshruni? The shock had been so total he simply blurted these words. Now it was Eleazarus who was startled.
You do have a facility for lies, the Grand Master said after a moment.
And you for delusion. Geshruni was the best-placed informant the Mandate has had in a generation. Why would we kill him? The clamor had swelled. Riotous figures heaved in Akamian's periphery, shaking fists, bellowing insults and accusations. But they seemed curiously trivial, as though rendered smoke by the absurdity of this, his first meeting with the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires. Eleazarus studied him for a pensive moment, then shook his head ruefully, as though saddened by the persistence of hardened liars.
Why is any informant murdered, hm? In so many ways, so many men are more useful dead. But as I mentioned, it was the manner that sparked my admittedly morbid curiosity.
Scowling, Akamian hunched his shoulders in disbelief.
Someone plays you for a fool, Grandmaster. Someone plays both of us. But who?
Eleazarus glared, pursing his lips as though holding a bitter segment of lime against his teeth.
My master of spies warned me of this, he said tightly. I'd assumed you had some obscure reason for what you did, something belonging to your accursed gnosis. But he insisted that you are simply mad, and he told me I'd know by the way you lied. Only madmen and historians, he said, believe their lies.
First I'm a murderer, and now I'm a madman?
Indeed.
Eleazarus spat in a tone of condemnation and disgust.
Who else collects human faces?
Just then, more stones sailed over their heads. Suppressing the urge to wring his hands, Eleazarus blinked away images of his near-disastrous encounter with a mandate schoolman the previous day. The face of one nameless man haunted him in particular, a strapping Tidoni Thane, his left eye snow-blue in the wake of an old scar. Some faces were more suited to expressions of malice than others, certainly, but this man, at the time he'd seemed the very incarnation of hatred, an infernal deity in the guise of calloused flesh and fevered blood.
They despise us so, and well they should.
Rather than bear the indignity of camping outside Momum's walls, the Scarlet Spires had leased, at an exorbitant price, a nearby villa from one of the Nansur houses. By Ainani standards, it was rather severe, more of a fortress than a villa, but then Eleazarus supposed the Ainani never had to build with the Skilvendi in mind. And at least it allowed him a certain measure of tranquil luxury. The encamped holy war had become an intolerable slum, as his recent expedition to meet that thrice-damned mandate schoolman had reminded him. Eleazarus had dismissed his slaves and now sat alone in a shaded portico overlooking the villa's single courtyard. He studied Iacchus, his master of spies and closest advisor, as he made his pale way through the sunlit gardens. The man hurried, as though chased by the surrounding brilliance. Watching him move from sun to shadow was like witnessing dust blink into stone. Iacchus nodded as he approached his chair. His very presence often touched Eleazarus with menace, something like glimpsing the first flush of plague in a man's face. The smell of his old-fashioned perfumes, however, carried a strange sense of comfort.
I have news from Sumna,
Iacchus said, pouring himself a silver bowl of wine from the table.
About Kutiga.
Until recently, Kutiga had been their last surviving spy in the Thousand Temples. All the others had been executed. His handler had not heard from him in weeks.
So you think he's dead?
Eleazarus asked sourly.
Yes,
Iacchus replied. After all these years, Eleazarus had grown accustomed to Iacchus, but somewhere in his own body lurked a small memory of his initial revulsion. Iacchus was addicted to Canv, the drug that held a greater part of the Ainani ruling castes within its clasp. Except, and this thought often surprised Eleazarus, for Kefaramuni, the latest puppet they had installed on the Ainani throne. For those who could afford her sweet bite, Canv sharpened the mind and extended one's life for periods greater than 100 years, but it also sapped the body of its pigment, and some said the soul of its will. Iacchus looked the same now as the day Eleazarus had joined the school as a boy, many, many years before. Unlike other addicts, Iacchus refused to use cosmetics to compensate for the deficits of his skin, which was more translucent than the greased linen that the poor used in their windows. Like dark, arthritic worms, veins branched across his features. One could even see the dark in the center of his red eyes when he closed his lids. His fingernails were waxy black from bruising. As Iacchus drew his chair to the table, a tiny sweat touched Eleazarus, and he found himself glancing at the length of his own tanned arms. As thin as they were, they possessed wiry strength, vitality. Despite the disturbing aesthetics of addiction, Eleazarus himself might have succumbed to the drug's lure, particularly because of the way it reputedly sharpened the intellect. Perhaps the only aspect of Canv that had prevented him from slipping into that wan and strangely narcissistic love affair, addicts rarely married or produced live children, was the unsettling fact that no one knew its source. For Eleazarus, this was intolerable. Throughout his vicious, steep climb to the pinnacle he'd now reached, he had always refused to act in ignorance of crucial facts. Until this day.
"So, we have no more sources in the Thousand Temples?"
Eleazarus asked, though he already knew the answer.
"None worth listening to. A shroud has fallen across Sumna."
Eleazarus glanced across the bright grounds, cobbled paths lined by spear-like junipers, a gigantic willow draped about a pool of glassy green, guards with falcon faces.
"What does this mean, Iolcus?" he asked.
"I've delivered the greatest school in the three seas to its greatest peril."
"It means we must have faith,"
Iolcus said with an air of shoulder-shrugging fatalism.
"Faith in this Mathanet."
"Faith? In someone we know nothing of?"
"That's why it's faith."
The decision to join the Holy War had been the most difficult of Eleazarus's life. At first, upon receiving Mathanet's invitation, he had wanted to laugh. The Scarlet Spires? Joining a Holy War? The prospect was too absurd to warrant even momentary consideration. Perhaps this is why Mathanet had included a gift of 6 trinkets with his invitation. Trinkets were the one thing that a sorcerer could not laugh away. "This offer," the trinket said, "demands serious consideration." Then Eleazarus had realized what it was that Mathanet truly offered them. Vengeance.
"Then we must double our expenditures in Sumna, Iolcus. This is intolerable."
"I agree. Faith is intolerable."
A 10-year-old image of the man assailed Eleazarus, sent faint tremors through his fingertips, Iolcus falling against him in the aftermath of the assassination, his skin blistered, streaked by blood, his mouth croaking the very words that had lashed through Eleazarus's soul ever since. How could they do this? It was uncanny the way certain days defied the passage of years, became virulent, and plagued the present as an undying yesterday. Even here, far from the Scarlet Spires and 10 years on, Eleazarus could still smell sweet roasted flesh, so much like swine left overlong on the spit. How long had it been since he'd last been able to stomach pork? How many times had he dreamt of that day? Sashioka had been Grand Master then. They'd been meeting in the council chambers deep in the galleries beneath the Scarlet Spires, discussing the possible defection of one of their number to the Maisunse school. The most sacrosanct chambers of the Scarlet Spires were nested in wards. One could not step or lean against bare stone without feeling the indent of inscription or the aura of incantations. And yet the assassins had simply flickered into existence. A strange noise, like the humming flutter of netted birds, and a light, as though a door had been thrown open across the surface of the sun, framing 3 figures, 3 hellish silhouettes. Shock, chilling bone, and paralyzing thought, and then furniture and bodies were blown against the walls, blinding ribbons of the purest white lashed across the corners of the room, shrieks, terror clawing through his bowels. Sheltered by a hollow between the wall and an overturned table, Eleazarus had crawled through his own blood to die, or so he thought. Some of his peers still survived. He glimpsed the instant that Sashioka, his predecessor and teacher, crumpled beneath the blinding touch of the assassins, and Iolcus, on his knees, his pale head blackened by blood, swaying behind the shimmering of his wards, struggling to reinforce them. Cataracts of light obscured him, and Eleazarus, somehow unnoticed by the intruders, felt the words boil to his lips. He could see them, 3 men in saffron robes, 2 crouching, 1 erect, bathed in the incandescence of their exertions. He saw serene faces with the deep sockets of the blind and energies wheeling from their foreheads as though through a window to the outside. A golden phantom reared from Eleazarus's outstretched hands, a scaled neck, a mighty crest, jaws scissoring open. With a queen's deliberate grace, the dragon's head dipped and scourged the Kishorim with fire. Eleazarus had wept with rage. Their wards collapsed, stone cracked, the flesh was swept from their bones. Their agony had been too brief. Then, quiet, strewn bodies, Sashioka a sizzling ruin, Iacchus gasping on the floor. Nothing. They had sensed nothing. The Yanta had only been bruised by their own sorceries. It was as if the Kishorim had never been. Iacchus stumbling toward him. How could they do this? The Kishorim had started their long and secret war. Eleazarus would end it. Vengeance. This was the gift the Shraya of the Thousand Temples had offered them. The gift of their ancient enemy. A holy war. A perilous gift. It had occurred to Eleazarus that the holy war was in fact what the six trinkets were symbolically. To give Kore to a sorcerer was to give something that could not be taken, to make a gift of his death and impotence. By taking the vengeance proffered by Mathanet, Eleazarus and the Scarlet Spires had given themselves to the holy war. By seizing, Eleazarus realized he had surrendered. And now the Scarlet Spires, for the first time in its glorious history, found itself dependent upon the whims of other men. "And what of our spies in the Imperial precincts?" Eleazarus asked. He loathed fear, so he would avoid discussing Mathanet if he could. "Have they discovered anything more of the Emperor's plan?"
"Nothing, so far,"
Iacchus replied dryly.
"There's a rumor, however, that Icuri Confis received a message from the Phanum shortly after the destruction of the Vulgar Holy War."
"A message? Regarding what?"
"The Vulgar Holy War, presumably.
But what was its import? Was it an acknowledgement? A receipt for an agreed-upon transaction? Was it an admonition, a warning against any further action by the Holy War? Or a premature peace overture? What was it?"
"Any of those things," Iacchus replied. "Or perhaps all. We've no way of knowing."
"Why send it to Icuri Confis?"
"For any number of reasons. He was, recall, the Zapata Shah's hostage for a time."
"That boy, Confis, he's the one we must worry about."
Icuri Confis was intelligent, excessively so, which inevitably meant that he was unscrupulous as well. Another frightening thought. He will be our general. Holding the silver bowl in steepled fingers, Iacchus seemed to gaze at the small coin of wine in its bottom.
"May I speak frankly, Grandmaster?"
he asked at length.
"By all means."
Emotion pooled in Iacchus's face as readily as water in a sackcloth, but his apprehension was now plain.
"The Scarlet Spires is degraded by all this,"
he began uncomfortably.
"We've become subordinates when our destiny is to rule. Abandon this holy war, Eli. There's too much uncertainty, too many unknowns. We play number sticks with our very lives."
"You too, Iacchus?"
Eleazarus felt coils of rage flex about his heart. The Kishorim had planted a serpent within him those 10 years ago, and it had grown fat on fear. He could feel it writhe within him, animate his hands with a womanish desire to scratch out Iacchus's disconcerting eyes. But he said only,
"Patience, Iacchus. Knowing is always a matter of patience."
"Yesterday, Grandmaster, you were almost killed by the very men we're to march with. If that doesn't demonstrate the absurdity of our position, then nothing does."
He referred to the riot. What a fool he'd been to corner Drusus Akamian in such a place. All of it could have ended there. Hundreds of pilgrims dead at the hands of a Grand Master, the Scarlet Spires at open war with the men of the Tusk, if it hadn't been for the level head of the Mandate Schoolmen.
"Don't do it, Eleazarus!"
the man had cried as the mob surged toward them. Think of your war against the Kisharim. But there had been a threat in the slovenly man's voice as well. I won't let you do it. I'll stop you, and you know I can. What perverse irony. For the threat, not the reason, had stayed his hand. The threat of the Gnosis. His designs had been saved by the lack of the very thing his school had coveted for generations. How he despised the mandate. All the schools, even the Imperial's sake, recognized the ascendancy of the Scarlet Spires, save for the mandate. And why should they, when a mere field spy could cow their Grand Master?
The incident,
Eleazarus replied,
merely demonstrates something we've always known, Iocas. Our position in the Holy War is precarious, true. But all great designs require great sacrifices. When all this comes to fruition, when Shaima is smoking ruin and the Kisharim are extinct, the Mandate will be the only school left that can humble us.
An arcane empire, that would be the wages of his desperate labor.
Which reminds me, Iocas said, I received a missive from the Minister of Records in Carathuzel. He went through all reports of the dead, as you directed. There was another, from years back.
Another faceless corpse.
Do we know who he was? What were the circumstances?
Half-rotted. Found in the Delta. The man was unknown. Because 5 years have passed, we have little hope of determining his identity.
The Mandate. Who would have guessed that they played such dark games? But what game? Yet another unknown.
Perhaps, Iocas continued, the Mandate has at long last put aside all that tripe about the consort and the no-god.
Eleazarus nodded.
I agree. The Mandate now plays as we play, Iocas. That man, Drusus Akamian, left little doubt of that.
Such a gifted liar. Eleazarus had almost believed he knew nothing of Gishruni's death.
If the Mandate is part of the game, Iocas said, everything changes. Do you realize that? We can no longer count ourselves the first school of the three seas.
First, we crush the Kisharim, Iocas. In the meantime, make certain that Drusus Akamian is watched.